Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The internet and social media are believed to have changed how we express ourselves and share our thoughts with the rest of the world. But a new survey of Facebook and Twitter users suggests that they may be less willing to honestly share their political views online and face-to-face. Joining us now by phone from Washington, D.C. is Lee Rainey, director of the Pew Research Center Internet Project. Welcome back to the show, Lee.
Hi, Ann.
So the survey focused on people's views of the Edward Snowden and the NSA spying revelations. Why did you focus on that for the survey?
We were basing our work on a long-standing communications finding that there's a thing called a spiral of silence, that people well before the internet would not likely express their opinions if they thought their friends or their audience disagreed with them. So we wanted to test and see if the spiral of silence also existed in the social media environment of the modern age. And in order to do that work, you have to pick issues where there is a lot of dispute and contention. So when we were doing the survey in the fall last year, the Snowden NSA revelations were very much speaking to a divided public. The other Pew Research surveys we were doing showed there was a lot of dispute over about it. So there were ways to talk to people about, you know, folks at work, their neighbors, their family members, and others, and to test whether they would be willing to speak about these issues if it came up in a variety of contexts.
How did you tease out their discomfort?
We asked them if they'd be willing to speak, and we asked about a variety of settings. Would you be willing to speak at a family dinner? Would you be willing to speak with your fellow coworkers? Would you be willing to speak with your neighbors? Would you be willing to speak at a public meeting? We also asked, would you be willing to speak on Facebook or Twitter? And that was the surprising finding here, that the people who are active in social media were less likely to be willing to speak than people who would speak up in those public places. And even more surprisingly, if people who use Facebook and Twitter thought that their followers and friends disagreed with them, they were also less likely to speak in those in-person settings, like at a meal or with colleagues or coworkers or things like that. So we're sort of picking up a little bit of evidence, not for sure, but a little bit of evidence that the spiral of silence that starts in social media might carry over into in-person encounters. And that's not a good thing for democracy. If we don't share our views, and even especially if we don't learn minority views, the basic idea of democratic theory is you get less information, you get less idea of what's going on in the culture, and you make worse decisions.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Lee Rainey. He's director of the Pew Research Center Internet Project, and we're talking about a survey that focused on the spiral of silence and whether being online would change whether or not somebody is willing to share their personal viewpoints on politics, controversial topics. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So the idea was, and the hope was for, say, the internet in general, that this is going to be this great marketplace of ideas where you didn't have to be rich to be able to express yourself, and you didn't have to own something. You could just go on Facebook or Twitter and say whatever you wanted, but that's not necessarily the case.
That's exactly what the hope was. The other thing that people were hoping, of course, was that this spiral of silence was well documented in the generations before the internet came mm-hmm. into people's lives. So maybe by providing new kinds of spaces for conversations, like Facebook and Twitter and even email, that you might surface more opinions. People might be more willing to share their views, even if they thought they were not the majority's views. And in fact, we're finding the opposite. You know, when we started this research, we actually didn't know what we were going to find. We didn't have a hypothesis. We mm-hmm. just knew it was an interesting theory about what the internet was doing to political conversation. We've seen other evidence that, especially when it comes to political participation, will people participate in meetings, sign petitions, get out and vote and things like that? Social media users are more active than other people. So we were kind of expecting that the spiral of silence would be a little less in evidence on social media. But we actually found that instead of on participation, where it went up, and when it came to deliberation, there was less conversation going on than probably in the past.
And the expectation was that if you don't have to be face-to-face with people, you don't have to have that be in that room and have the intimidation factor of being face to face, that you might be more willing to express yourself. And that didn't seem to make any difference. What do we know about that? Why that's not the case?
Well, the longstanding findings about the spiral of silence is that people don't speak up because they fear loneliness and isolation. They feel like if they express their views, particularly if the views aren't held by their audience, they'll be shunned or they'll lose friends or they will, you know, be thrown out of the group or whatever. And on social media, we were thinking that maybe the opposite would be true, that even if you held minority views, you could see other people who shared your views, and that might embolden you to speak up. Or you could belong to a crowd if you assembled your own social network on Facebook or Twitter. You could see, you know, your views reflected in that crowd, even if they weren't majority views. And so there were a whole lot of ways that we were thinking that this new environment might encourage more minority opinions to surface, and that, you know, and Democratic, you know, theorists would say that would be a good thing.
You know, if you go to the comment sections, like go online to any newspaper or any news organization, and then there's comment sections after that, I don't see any shortage of vitriol and expression. Is that different?
Yeah, there's more than would be evident in in-person settings. There's a lot of experimental research that showed that people are less inhibited when they are anonymous in commenting on things like that. So if they'll just let it fly. There's a lot of, you know, really ugly, hideous stuff that people wouldn't be saying to each other if they risked a punch in the nose or risked their audience crying. But now there's a lot of evidence that people will speak up. So one of the paradoxes we've been asked about in this research is, come on, you guys. In social media, everybody speaks up. We see lots of opinions. Why are you saying that there are fewer opinions? And the answer is partly also explained by other parts of communication theory. People will speak up under three circumstances, even if they have minority views or they're worried that their audience doesn't agree with them. The first factor is how much they know. So if they think they know a lot, they'll speak up no matter whether they think their audience will agree or not. The second is their intensity of their opinions, and we all see that on social media. If people believe something strongly, they're going to say it no matter what. They won't self-censor because they just, you know, they're true believers. And the final thing is their level of interest. If they've been following a news story like Snowden NSA or like Ferguson or any of the stories at the modern moment, they're also more likely to speak up than people who are only episodically following events or not really paying attention at all. So this doesn't say that all opinion is stifled or self-centered. What it says is certain kinds of people will always speak up in places like social media. And what's not true about social media is that people who wouldn't have spoken up in the past in those in-person settings because they were worried about the opinions of their listeners also won't speak up in social media.
If I'm face-to-face, you know, at a dinner party, I don't have a problem, but I wouldn't necessarily post something on Facebook because that becomes part of my record. People can see that.
That's another thing that we think is going on here. So there are a couple of sort of quirky things about this research that we just ought to acknowledge. The first is the subject we were asking about was government surveillance of what happens on the internet,
right.
People's cell phone calls. So maybe some people said, well, I just don't want to speak up because I don't want, you know, the NSA or anybody else to know what I think about this. But the other thing that, you know, speaks very much to what you were just talking about is that in a lot of circumstances in social media, what you say goes on the permanent record. And maybe people will self-censor because they might have an opinion now, but they don't know if they'll have the same opinion in 5 years, and they don't know if this will impress or turn off a prospective romantic partner or a new boss that they might be applying to in a couple of years, or any one of these things that relates to the permanence of what goes on online. And it's so searchable. So it's permanent and searchable. Mm-hmm. So everything that people are saying now in social media, particularly if they've got open settings and they don't have a lot of privacy settings, you know, it's searchable back into their past. We all have these digital shadows that walk around with us.
And is there anything to suggest that by using social media the way we have now for about a generation, all things being equal, that's affecting our willingness to speak out in social situations face to face?
There's a little bit in our evidence. So the people who thought that they are social media users who thought that their followers in Facebook and Twitter disagreed with them were less likely to speak up in work settings, were less likely to speak out at a public meeting and things like that. So what we are thinking, hypothesizing about this environment is that social media has allowed more people to watch what's going on in their surroundings. They see a lot more opinions. They see a lot more pictures. They see a lot more of everything. And this sort of pervasive availability of lots of commentary in the culture might actually also be making people think, well, why should I risk speaking out? Because I don't know who's going to disagree with me. It's going to be on my permanent record. It might come back to haunt me. And there might be a fight that someone's going to pick with me that I don't really need in my life. So there are a whole host of ways that this tool or set of tools that people were hoping was going to encourage more mm-hmm. conversation, more interaction, more deliberation, might not be working that way.
Were there any interesting differences in age or gender in your findings?
Not really. In other words, social media users of all ages, and when you do this statistical modeling that compares, that makes sure that you're looking at the right thing and not having other effects clutter up your data, we didn't see any age differences. There were few differences between men and women. Men are a little bit more likely to speak out than women. And there were some traditional differences that also showed up. People who have higher levels of education are much more likely to want to speak up than people who don't have as much education. And sometimes it's people in better off households are also more likely to speak up.
And did the topic matter?
Well, we didn't ask about any other topic okay. besides the NSA Snowden story, mm-hmm. and we're not, there's more work to be done because there are different kinds of stories at which this comes up, and of course, we're only talking about political discussion. We're not talking
right.
about personal, intimate stuff or things that's going on in the community that aren't necessarily controversial. This is a slice of social media life that really relates to political deliberation.
And just to get back to the idea of well before the internet, that basically what you're saying is the internet or the social media by way of the internet hasn't really changed anything.
This is a long-standing human condition that's been documented for a couple of generations in scholarship, that people are less likely to want to speak up if they think their audience disagrees with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they fear isolation. They fear being shunned by their friends. They fear arguments that they don't want to have. I mean, think of the Thanksgiving dinner table. That's a perfect example. Just
yeah.
certain topics don't come up because, people who are members of the same family or friends don't want to annoy each other and don't want to go off on a tangent on what's supposed to be a celebratory day. So this is something that has been built into human community and human deliberation for a long time. And the question was whether the internet had maybe changed the dynamics. And our answer, at least in this particular case study, is not. It's not the case. It hasn't changed the way humans have basically behaved for a long time.
Let's hear real quick from Ron in Cincinnati. Hi, Ron. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Social media really needs to wake up. People need to start talking out. We have a lot of problems, and it's really built it up over years and years and years. I know it's not going to change overnight, but the American people need to wake up because we're being robbed, stolen from, and our government is in bad shape.
And Lee Rainey, that's sort of the idea you had was we need to talk to each other, and unfortunately, this isn't the way we're doing it.
Well, in a social science sort of pure lab coat environment,
mm-hmm.
the basic idea is the more information that's shared with the more people, you get a better result. You get to test your ideas and see where there are holes in them or defend them or things like that. More information surfaces as people with special perspectives and maybe minority perspectives speak up. So there's a lot of evidence over long period of research that more is better. Even if it's unpleasant and uncomfortable to hear all of this contention going on in society. And it turns out social media is not necessarily the cure-all for it all. Other things are going to have to happen if we ever get to that sort of perfect lab coat environment.
All right. Well, Lee Rainey, and by the way, Ron in Cincinnati, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Lee Rainey, thanks to you for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Ann.
Lee Rainey's director of the Pew Research Center Internet Project. We'll have a link to the article from pewinternet.org on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Tech Tuesday continues. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The cogs of the wheel of the federal government turn slowly and appear to stand still when compared to the likes of Silicon Valley. The contrast has something to do with who is turning those respective cogs. Joining us now by phone is technology writer for Medium, Stephen Levy, who recently wrote about government and IT for Wired. Welcome back to the show, Stephen.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Obama's chief technology officer is leaving his post and he's headed back to the West Coast. In your piece for Wired, you followed Todd Park, the now former chief technology officer. Explain the conditions under which he was hired and how he managed during his tenure in that position.
Sure. You know, Todd actually was the second CTO of the U.S. The job was created under the Obama administration, and he came in after, you know, Todd actually came in with Obama and was the CTO of the Health and Human Services and moved over, I believe, in 2012, to take over the post. His tenure changed dramatically during the collapse of the healthcare.gov website, which was sort of Obama's Katrina. It was this utter disaster, and it was in technology. And, you know, it was sort of significant because the thing that Todd's main focus was is bringing the government's technology infrastructure and the way they do big projects out of the mid-20th century, really, and try to bring it into the 21st century. And this was a classic case where the old calcified ways that they did things really came and bit back on them in a very public and embarrassing and politically damaging way. And Todd actually switched to helping put together the team that fixed the site and wound up sleeping in his office for weeks on end.
Well, so what is the problem? I mean, why aren't people on board? Is it just really a matter of people?
Well, it's not just people. It's the systems they have that are sort of self-perpetuating. It's very tough to change these systems. There's some entrenched interests that like the system the way it is. They, you know, some big contractors like the idea that they can come in and get hundreds of millions of dollars and never have to answer for their performance. And the people I talked to who helped rescue the site were a different kind of technology specialist than you saw working for government. They were brought in from Silicon Valley. They worked at places like Google and even some internet startups, and they were appalled at what they saw because what the rest of the world has adopted as a ways to run software and build websites that consumers use, has not hit Washington, D.C. yet. They use outdated technology and outdated methods, and the way the procurement systems work is that the contracts are almost built for failure. So healthcare.gov was not an anomaly. It was just a very public display of the, you know, very frequent failures you see in government sites. People who study this know, like the FBI has spent, decades to come up with a file system where they can keep track of the crimes and the criminals. And the Veteran Administration is the new place that people are focusing on for sites that don't work, as, veterans have to wait months to get their, disabilities classified. So this is a pretty common thing. And Todd Park was really focused very hard on trying to address this problem.
The Social Security Administration, you wrote about that as well. It spent 6 years and nearly $300 million on its disability claim filing process, and it's still not finished.
That's right. And, what happens is that these big projects get assigned, and no one is really responsible for them. They're assigned to multiple contractors, and it's usually the same few contractors, and they give them a big list of features. They tell them this site has to have this, this has to have that, but it never says that the site has to respond in, X milliseconds to a request, or the site has to be up a certain percentage of time. So the kinds of things that matter in the real world really aren't brought into this there. It is a big problem. Plus, the sites, generally aren't user-friendly in the way that you see on Amazon and Google and Facebook and these other things. And, people are used to getting good responsiveness from, the things they participate in digitally. And people expect the government to move along with that, and it hasn't happened. And what Park saw was, well, maybe if I could bring in the practices of Silicon Valley, as well as some of the best people who traditionally have been loath to join the government because mm-hmm. of the way it operates, so maybe we could turn that around. And I actually attended an event where, he was pitching to about 100 really great engineers in Silicon Valley who work for some of the best companies. And he gave a fiery speech telling them, this is your way to serve your country here. It was a recruitment speech. It was like Uncle Sam needs you, the engineers.
Well, let's talk about why it is a problem before Park. Why is it a problem? You're saying they're loath to work for the federal government. What's the difference in cultures?
Well, in the federal government, traditionally you work for one of these projects here. You go in there, and there's these requirements. They're very inflexible, it's software, really requires sometimes, approach a problem, in many different ways there. And, the successful companies in Silicon Valley realized in order to get a successful project going, in order to, launch a complicated piece of software, you have to try things, see what works, see what doesn't work. You have to test them out as you go along. And this has not been part of the government culture. And when I did the story, I learned that there was, there's been a revolution in the way you develop big software over the past decade or so. And it's something called the agile approach. And it's an approach that means, you work in small teams. Everyone's on the same page. You monitor how the software works constantly from the very beginning. You test everything and see how it's working and how it's going there. The government doesn't do this. It just has these big goals in the beginning and sort of inflexible the way it operates. And this is called the waterfall process. It's a very top-down kind of thing that uses a lot of people, a lot more people, but is less effective in getting things done. So this battle between agile and waterfall has been won in the private sector by the agile approach, but the government's been still stuck on waterfall. And what Todd Park wanted to do was move it to the agile thing. And, his most recent thing was just announced a couple weeks ago, is he created this thing called the United States Digital Service, the U.S. Digital Service, which is, put in there to bring a small team of top technology people to go within, agencies and institutions in the government and convert them to that. They even have a playbook for the best practices that places should use when they develop software.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Stephen Levy. He's a senior writer, now works at Medium. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Park introduced a program called Presidential Innovation Fellows. How did that work?
That was one of the first things he did, is he decided to, because it's very tough to lure someone from Silicon Valley to work full-time for the government, is that he decided to use the power of the president and bring people in to the government for a limited tenure. So he brought some very bright people in. They called them the first class of Presidential Innovation Fellows, and they were to serve generally for a year. And there's been three classes of those people so far, including some terrific people like Jen Palka, who founded Code for America, which is a sort of a parallel process to get people into local governments to help change things. And, you know, by doing this, you know, he hoped to actually lure them into spending more of their lives working with government. They'd catch the bug, the reform bug, and like him, spend multi-years doing it. And, you know, so he was well-positioned when he was tasked with helping fix the healthcare problem because he had this group of people who some of them could help out and some of them had great networks of connections. So they brought the people in who eventually fixed the site. And, you know, also another outgrowth of these fellows was they built this little organization within the General Services Administration also to take on projects very quickly and be almost a test bed to show the rest of government that you could do things by this new approach.
Does government pay enough for them, though?
Well, generally, you know, government can't match it. You know, there's no big salaries and certainly no stock options like you have in the private sector. Mm-hmm. You know, the secret is that these great technologists are not motivated strictly by money. They want to change the world. And that's what's really turned them off government. No one wants to work on a project for 5 years that, you know, doesn't work and a new contract has to be, you know, let out to start from the beginning. You know, so that's what's been really keeping the great people away from government. But if it works, it's really a chance to change people's lives because millions of people, you know, depend on government for vital services there. And if you could, come up with something that really helps those people get connected with healthcare and, you know, their benefit checks and things like that, you really change things. And that's what really motivates great technology.
So in the case of healthcare.gov, a lot of contractors were hired to put that together, but no one was responsible for making sure the site was operational. So then in comes Todd Park, and he kind of makes it operational. Who's taken his place? I mean, who have they learned from that?
Well, you know, I think that there has been learning in it, particularly within, you know, the part of, you know, the Medicare, Medicaid, you know, services there. And it's been an experience really for both sides, you know, because they didn't do all the work. They brought in a small team, you know, which rebuilt a core part of the site. And they worked with some of the existing people and they showed them the way these new methods would work. It was sort of under a shotgun because things really had to get going. But, you know, I talked to people who were lifers in government tech, and they mm-hmm. said, you know, hey, we like this new way of doing things. Maybe some of the contractors who get millions of dollars by hiring, hundreds of more people on the same thing may not like it so much, and that's where the war is going to be. I think that, you know, there's been learning on both sides, particularly from the government side, and there's a ways to go. Now, who's going to replace Todd? I think whoever it's going to be, it looks like it's going to be a Silicon Valley person. The person mentioned most often who's going to be his replacement is this woman called Megan Smith, who's a longtime, very respected Silicon Valley executive. She worked for some of the hot startups in the past, like General Magic. She worked for Apple. And most recently, she spent a long time at Google. She was an early Google employee. And she's a terrific engineer as well as, you know, a really smart organizer. She worked in business development in Google for a number of years. And most recently has been part of their research division at Google X. So I'm sure she would share some of those values and work closely with Todd Park as he moves full time to, you know, push his agenda from Silicon Valley and actually, you know, go really deep into recruitment out from there. And the main reason he moved back out there was because his family really wanted to go back there. He promised them it wouldn't be that long he'd spend in Washington, D.C. when he took the job. And that was in 2009 when he took his first job. So they were, you know, I think they were ready to say, Todd, you got to move us back home here.
You wrote about a new program called 18F. Can you talk about how that came together and what it does?
Yeah, that's the one within the General Services Administration.
Okay.
And it was, you know, an outgrowth of the the idea that they could do something in a small group to make a big impact.
Okay.
And the inspiration really was something that was happening in the UK, where they, you know, had again, you know, a small group that actually went in and told the agencies that they had to get with the new program. They had to reform their methods, otherwise they wouldn't get funded there. Now, the 18F doesn't have that kind of power over the agencies. What they try to do is they say, hey, we can do this project for you, and they'll do, a project, maybe not a giant thing like doing the whole computer systems, but they'll do something, like smaller. They'll do it in, a much shorter amount of time than it would have taken in traditional methods, and it'll look like a beautiful website. I visited the 18F group, and it was more like visiting a Silicon Valley startup than it was, going in the government. They're working in an open loft-like system, and they wear casual clothes, and they do a daily stand-up every day, like you see in Silicon Valley. So their idea is, they're going to be proof of concept that this could work that way. This other thing I mentioned, the U.S. Digital Service.
Yeah, it sounds like the Forestry Service or something.
Yeah, that's a little closer to what, you see in the U.K., which has worked so well. Huh. But again, they don't have the big stick that, that they have in the U.K. They have a little more power, because it's under the Chief Information Officer's office, and he has some, executive power over the agencies, but it's sort of tricky. It's hard to get things moving in Washington.
Yeah, well, what about the big stick? Why don't they give him a big stick?
Well, it's tough. I looked the whole time I did the story, and I really was working on it a period of months, my last story at Wired, who is the legislator, the person in Congress, the Senate or the House, who took this as like a main cause. And there were some people on board with this, but no one's really standing up, and saying, this is my big issue, even though, it really touches every American, and it is sort of a transformation that really has to happen there. I think in part because these contractors have some power there, and they've sort of made things nice for themselves, and, people in Congress just don't upset that apple cart there. Also, people are a little intimidated when they hear people in Silicon Valley say things like "move fast and break things." That's what we like to do. when you take a risk in government, chances are you're going to be hauled before some congressional committee, and the questions you're asked aren't really a sincere attempt to get to the bottom of what happened. There's just some sort of showboating and things like that. And I can tell you from looking into it and spending a lot of time with the people at fixhealthcare.gov, one thing, that was always on their mind, I think it maybe even slowed the process a little, was the fear that, one wrong step and they would be hauled before a committee. And these are people who are giving up their everyday, their normal, very comfortable existence in Silicon Valley to go out there, and be away from their families and work, incredible hours, out of patriotism, really, to fix the government. Yet, they knew that one wrong step and they'd be hauled before Congress and, painted as villains.
Well, how can the contractors spend $300 million on a revamp of the Social Security Administration and their claim filing process, which still is not finished, and these other guys worry about one misstep?
Well,
is it because when you're working directly for the government, is there a different?
So, well, I mean, I think, to be fair, if each time one of these big contracts fails, there is, a 3-day, scandal flap in Washington about it, and some people, wring their hands. But then the contracts seem to go to the same people the next time.
Right.
Or a different contractor. In one case, someone was talking about a Social Security thing, and they said that, they fired one contractor, and the new contractor came, hired the same people, and it was the same thing all over again. They just handed it off to a different company. I think that, these people have had the political clout to get contracts written in a way where, it only fit those big companies that get the contract. And one thing that Park and his team have tried to do, and Steve Van Roekel, the Chief Information Officer, has also been working at this, is to try to get different kinds of procuring processes where you could hire small teams. You could have startups work on, government projects. And I talk about one in the Veterans Administration. Their chief technical officer was a presidential innovation fellow, really smart woman named Marina Martin. And, because she's using a couple of small companies. One of them sprang actually from some of the people who worked on healthcare.gov to do a project for the Veterans Administration.
So there's hope.
Well, there is some hope, but it's a hard climb.
Okay.
This is Washington we're talking about.
Right, exactly. Stephen Levy.
And Washington on the East Coast.
Exactly. Well, listen, thanks a lot for talking to us today, and congratulations on your new job at Medium. Good luck.
Thank you. I'm really excited. I'm starting a new tech site for Medium, and now I'm working for startups. This is fun.
Okay. Stephen Levy, he's a senior writer. Well, you're starting a tech startup for
That's
Medium.
Right. A new editor-in-chief. Yes.
And, okay, great. And but you can find his article on the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Fans of Mario, Luigi, and Zelda and other Nintendo game characters got some exciting news last week. New upgrades are coming to Nintendo's handheld gaming devices. Joining us now to talk about that and more is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So there are new versions of Nintendo 3DS and 3DS XL that are on the way. Before we get to what's new, remind us what these handheld gaming devices are all about. I know people who still play with theirs from 10 years ago.
Yeah, Nintendo had this crazy idea just about 10 years ago to take their mobile gaming platform, their portable gaming platform, and give it two screens, one that's got a kind of a bottom touch screen for you to do interactive stuff and a top touch screen for you to view things. And it ended up being, a huge hit. They've made a lot of changes to it, making it thinner and, making the screens higher quality up until we have the current generation 3DS and 3DS XL. And they are now being updated. It's not clear if we will see them here in the U.S. before January or not, but I really hope that we do.
Meaning by Christmas time.
That would be ideal to see them by Christmas. But so they announced they're basically just calling them the new 3DS and the new 3DS XL. Both of them have slightly larger screens. The 3DS is going to be noticeably bigger as far as kind of longer and taller than its predecessor, and it has a button layout that is very similar to some of Nintendo's previous consoles. So it actually has, separate joysticks. It has two different, back buttons, two different sets of back buttons as opposed to the one that was previously there, with the kind of this goal that it would play more like a console that was in your hand instead of, kind of the traditionally limited experience that we're used to seeing from the kind of portable gaming system.
Okay, this is just my ignorance talking now, but does 3D have anything to do with it?
Yes. So the top screen is has always had a three-dimensional toggle switch that you could hit, where you turn it up into kind of a 3D mode, and the images that are on the top screen are all in 3D, and you can scale that down or turn it off completely. The previous generation, I had a lot of trouble personally with the 3D kind of messing with my eyes. So I usually turned it off by default. And I have three kids who all use DSs, and those are all turned off by default. But this new version promises to be a lot better.
Do you have to wear different kinds of glasses or something for it?
No. So this is what's called auto stereoscopic 3D, which means it's a pair of panels that lay on top of one another and create the 3D effect on the actual screen instead of needing to wear special glasses. And this is going to be a new way to make that happen. There's actually the camera that's on the front of the current 3DS is going to, you know, take a look and see like where your face is angled and make sure that those two panels line up so that you have the best kind of setup.
So what does the future look like for small gaming devices like these? Does Nintendo have a lot of competition? Are they going back to that younger market? Who are they selling it to, or who do they want to? And what do you think their goals are ultimately?
Well, Nintendo's biggest competition over the last couple of years has been smartphones and tablets.
Right.
You know, it's really hard to justify that, you know, $300 portable gaming system like a PlayStation Vita or a Nintendo 3DS when I've already got a phone or a tablet on me that plays a lot of the same games. Now, what has kept Nintendo, you know, popular over the last couple of years has been, you know, their exclusive content. You can't get a Mario game on anything other than a Nintendo console. You can't get a Zelda game on anything other than a Nintendo console. And that's going to be, you know, that's just the way things are going to be for a while. And that's a good thing if you really like those experiences. But as we've seen on Nintendo's Wii U console, that's not really enough anymore. There are tons of other games that people want to play. And if those games aren't available, then, you know, most people are going to go to the places where they are available.
So do you think larger screens, different button layout, the 3D improvements are going to make a difference? Do you think people want to get away from their tablets and their phones maybe a little bit?
I think that there's room enough for both experiences. I think that, you know, there are tons of people who prefer, you know, I've already got my phone in my pocket. There's no reason to put something else in my gadget bag or something like that. Whereas I know, you know, and this is just a, you know, personal reference, I know plenty of people who prefer to kind of put the phone down and walk away and, you know, play games as kind of a relaxing thing without worrying about a notification bringing them back into like a work email or something like mm-hmm. that. So I think that there's definitely enough space for, you know, both of these experiences to exist, but Nintendo really needed to create, you know, a more compelling reason for people to give the console a try. And I think that, you know, the new button layout allows for different kinds of games, which are more console-focused kinds of games. And I think that that's going to be a very big deal moving forward, is that, you know, that experience, at the very least, make it so that there are game developers who can make games for both mobile platforms and portable gaming platforms and have them be the same experience on both systems.
Hmm. Okay. And what about, you said, like something like $300?
No, these are actually the prices that they gave. No, this is the prices that they gave for the Japan launch.
Uh-huh.
We don't actually have U.S. or U.K. pricing or availability yet. But it's $154 for the regular 3DS and $181 for the 3DS XL.
And what are the big differences between the DS and the DS XL?
The biggest difference is screen size. The 3DS XL has always been the larger screen size, kind of built for adult hands.
Well, I wanted to talk about something else, Jolt, a head sensor that detects concussions. This should be of a lot of interest to, particularly with football season upon us, lots of parents whose kids are out there clunking their heads together. It's one of the biggest concerns in athletics. So tell us about this.
Yeah, so this is actually the you know, kind of offspring of a project that started with an MIT student. The Jolt sensor, you know, we have a lot of wearable tech already, smartwatches and things like that, that can detect movement and that can behave in a certain way based on movement, but not a whole lot of them record specific kinds of movement and store them. And that's what Jolt is all about, is, you know, it clips into a special band, or, you know, that they have plans to try and make it so that it fits into a helmet. It's this really tiny, you know, white plastic clip that, you know, has a battery life that ranges for a couple of weeks. But the idea is that you kind of set it where you want it and you leave it there for a couple of weeks. And at the end of that period, you plug it in, and all of the data that was collected as far as the motion that it received over that period of time gets uploaded into the computer so that you can take a look and see, you know, exactly what kind of hits you were taking.
So it sets a baseline, and then you can see when things change a lot. But you said it, you have to let it be for a couple weeks?
Well, no, it has the ability to collect data for a couple of weeks.
Gotcha. Okay.
The battery.
Okay.
you could unplug this thing once a day and plug it in if you really wanted to.
So what would somebody see? What would it be telling them?
Well, so they haven't given us a whole lot of information as far as what the resulting graphs look like for, you know, anything more than jogging or, you know, things like that. But mm-hmm. ideally, it would present a graph with just kind of a baseline. And as you go, you know, across that baseline to see, you know, based on what time and what activities you were doing, you know, the kind of impacts that your body is feeling. And this works for more than just, you know, a football perspective. It's also good for running. If you're running with incorrect footwear and so your feet are impacting the ground in an inconvenient or uncomfortable way, then Jolt will be able to better help you determine how that works.
And the sensor, if it detects a dangerous hit, it buzzes to let the player know, but it also works with a phone app. How does that work?
So it's Bluetooth, which means you can sync it to the phone really whenever you wanted to and gain information, just like, you know, any other fitness tracker.
Mm-hmm.
So and then the information could be made available that way. Or you could, you know, just take it and with the micro USB port, you know, connect it to your computer and gain the information that way.
It sounds like something parents might want to have on the sidelines.
It's definitely the kind of thing I think, you know, especially for sports users, considering that they're planning on being right around $100 a piece, then I can see, you know, especially high impact sports parents being interested in getting.
And describe to me again, what does it look like? I mean, where would it go? It goes inside the helmet or is it the helmet itself?
It's this little tiny white clip. It's okay. Really, you know, it's very, very small. And the idea is that it would clip onto, you know, kind of the inside bit of the helmet. One of the designs that they gave, there's this kind of headband. If you're just kind of out jogging and it clips onto the headband, it's smaller than kind of like a Bluetooth headset.
Speaking of Bluetooth headsets, Samsung has a new Bluetooth headphone or headset out, new earbuds called Gear Circle. What do they do?
The Gear Circle is a really neat kind of advanced design on something that we've seen a little while now, these kind of Bluetooth earbuds that are designed to hang around your neck. And so when you want to listen to music, you take them and you know, plug the earbuds themselves in. But when you're not listening to them, you have this kind of plastic band that hangs around your neck. And it's convenient if you are the kind of person who kind of needs music all the time for whatever job they're doing, or if you're running, because it means that you don't have a, you know, kind of a tether to your smartphone in your pocket, and you don't have to worry about wearing one of those fitness armbands. But yeah, they're not always particularly comfortable, and the Gear Circle is very, very minimal, runs it down to what is basically just the headphone cable itself and a little bit of plastic on either side that magnetically clips together the headphones, so that you've got this, you know, kind of necklace looking accessory.
And how much does it cost?
They are going to be probably somewhere around $110 or $130. Samsung hasn't actually announced it yet.
And are they comfortable?
They look incredibly comfortable. I haven't been able to touch one myself. They're designed to, you know, be, you know, Bluetooth earbuds. If you like earbuds, then they look like they would be particularly comfortable. I personally have never really found earbuds that are totally comfortable for me.
Yeah, me either, yeah.
But what's really cool about them is that when they're not in your ears, they can act as a notification buzz. And, you know, so if you get a phone call or something like that, you'll have the buzz around your neck to let you know that you're getting a phone call, and you can answer the phone without pulling the phone out of your pocket.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, the Bluetooth headphones. We are almost out of time, but maybe we can squeeze in a quick conversation about, well, actually, we have an email from Steve. Maybe we'll ask about this. He says, there are tons of rumors about the iPhone 6 announcement coming next week. The only rumor I truly believe is that the screen will be bigger. What rumors does Russell believe?
Everything that we have heard so far is that there is going to be two different screen sizes. One is going to be 4.7 inches. One is going to be 5.5 inches. 5.5 inches for an iPhone sounds huge. I'm still not totally sure that I believe that that's going to happen. But a 4.7 inch screen sounds perfect. I'm a huge fan of that particular size range. Anywhere between 4.7 and 5 inches for a screen size, I think is just comfortable enough to hold and use with one hand. My only real complaint about the last generation iPhone was that it was just a little too small when compared to some of the other devices that I use on a regular basis. And so I'm very much looking forward to seeing Apple do something in the 4.7-inch range.
What's the screen size now?
It's it had been 3.7 for the longest time, and then it got the bump to 4 inches diagonally. And so this is going to be – you will definitely notice a difference in size. It will look significantly bigger than the iPhone 5S.
All right. Well, Russell Holley, thanks again for joining us this week.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley, he's tech blogger at geek.com. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.